19 Abzali v. State. Ms. Dickinson for the appellant. Mr. Brooks for the State. Ms. Dickinson. I'm sorry. Take your time. And in accord with what I did the other attorneys, welcome to Carson City to both of you.
I want to fall over that purse. May it please the court, my name is Sharon Dickinson and I represent Mr. Abzali, who in the transcripts and through most of the court proceedings was referred to as Steve. I'd like to have permission to save about 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Certainly.
I'm going to begin my argument addressing the two issues of first impression that we briefed. The first one has to do with the core of prosecution for the crime of possession of child pornography. That's NRS 200.730. In this case, Steve was charged with 25 counts of pornography. And the counts were based on pictures that the district attorney's office or the detectives took off a DVD or CD that they had recovered from his apartment about 2 weeks after he had already been in custody. And this apartment was one where there were people coming and going and other people had keys. And there was another woman living there at the time. Now, we do not know what happened to the discs that they recovered because we were never given a copy of it. And what they did with these discs is they made a separate disc of 25 images, which they printed out and introduced at trial. And the disc of 25 images, when we reviewed it for appeal, was not, in fact, these pictures, but something else. The 25 images came from a disc and were not what was actually found in his apartment. Based on that, they charged him with knowingly and willingly having his possession for any purpose, film, a photograph, or other visual representation. Prior to trial, we filed a pretrial writ asking the court to dismiss these or reduce it to one count. The argument was, based on the Wilson and the Castile cases, this could only be one count based on the fact that it's a possession statute. The district court disagreed. The district court said that each image was a different crime unless there were multiple images that were a series of one continuous activity. And we argue on appeal that the district court was wrong based on the Wilson and Castile cases. Now, although Wilson and Castile are not based on the possession portion of the child pornography statutes, they're based on the production, use of a minor in the production of child pornography. In that case, the court had to decide what the core prosecution was. And what the court said was, the attempt of the legislature in passing the statutes was to criminalize the use of children in the production of child pornography, not to punish a defendant for each and every picture that he had taken while using a child to produce pornography. The court reasoned that if the legislature wanted to punish him for each and every picture, they would have. And so in the Wilson case, this court reduced the four counts of use of a child for production of pornography to one. And the Castile case, they also reduced those counts because they looked at the pictures and concluded that there were only so many instances, maybe five separate instances. In this case, the state tried to do and succeeded in making each count a picture like they had done in Castile and Wilson. But NRS 200.730 is a different statute. It's a possession statute. But we know that the analogy should be the same. Because when the court decided what to do in Wilson-Castile, they looked at the definition of a performance under 200.700. And in that case, they noted that the definition of performance means any play, film, photograph, computer-generated image, electronic representation, etc. Well, we know that the Wilson-Castile cases apply here because the elements are the same, film, photograph, other visual representation. So we would ask the court to rule that the core of prosecution for this is possession, not number of pictures. And I want to use an example here. I have a DVD, and this is my sister's keeper, but if the person has it and they have child pornography on it, under this statute, this one disc would be one count. But if someone takes those and takes each picture off there and then has 250 pictures, like the prosecutors did in this case, then we have 250 counts of the same pictures. I don't think
wasn't there the point, though, that there were different subjects, in other words, different performers using your analogy to the performance statute? It wasn't exactly, your analogy is imperfect because you're saying a film of a sequence of acts with one performer and one event. That might be one thing, but my understanding of the 25 pictures are they're different subjects and different acts depicted in those pictures, or am I wrong on that?
The court is correct, but I could have those same 25 on one film, which is apparently what the detectives had, and then they printed out 25. So it's the same thing. They were on one, at least that's my understanding of the facts, on one, they were downloaded onto one DVD. And if you interpret the statute to allow for printing those out and then charging someone with 25 or 250, then you're allowing the prosecutor to decide the crime. And I don't think that I don't think that's what the legislature had in mind.
Could you address the issue with respect to the grand jury composition for me?
Yes, Your Honor. Due process and equal protection, as well as the Fifth and Sixth Amendments of the U.S. Constitution, guarantee criminal defendants rights that include that their grand jury be drawn from a fair cross-section of the community. In view of this, the legislature has allowed defendants to challenge the grand jury, and they enacted NRS 172.055 and NRS 172.065. And so Steve decided to challenge the grand jury that indicted him. And in this case, we have three different grand juries that brought down superseding indictments over a period of about 2 months. What happened in this case, and I was involved in a lot of the pretrial motions, was that we filed a writ challenging the grand jury. We were interested in finding out how many minorities were on there, because Steve is a minority. Well, what happened is we were stopped every avenue we went. We tried to get information from the DA's office. We tried to get information from the court. The court said, we'll ask Judge Hardcastle, who is the chief judge. We went to the jury commissioner. We went to court administration. And Ms. Roundtree even went to the secretary of the DA's office, who was in charge of grand jury, all in the hopes of finding some information as to how the grand juries are compiled, what is the race, we were going to ask what the gender was, and we had other information we were requesting. Each way we went, we were stopped. You know, the DA's office said, no, we don't do that. We don't have to tell you, and everything is shredded. I think the court administrator or the jury commissioner filed a motion to quash a subpoena. The court, the district court, felt that we were entitled to this information, but he also felt that it was not available. And Judge Hardcastle said that we didn't follow the right procedure, so she wasn't going to give us any information. However, the district court told us he wasn't sure what the right procedure was. So we were stuck. We were not able to get the information to successfully challenge anything. But when I looked at the list of the names, I did see that there were more men listed than there were women. And that showed a disparity in the selection process. And I raised that in the brief. Now, we were not able to get the information on the gender. We also asked for zip codes to see where the letters are being sent, because the procedures that are set up by the legislature is that the court sends out 100 or 500 letters. The first 100 that they get back, they document, and I believe the district attorney's office then does a scope, does a record check on them. Then that 100 list goes to the judges, who in a secret meeting go ahead and select 50 to be on a list. Those 50 then go to, it would have been Judge Hardcastle at the time, who somehow randomly selects 17 people. And the district court judge in this case thought for sure that we would at least have a list of the 50 people, but no one ever found it, or no one would, if they did have it, they wouldn't turn it over to us. We asked for this information because we wanted to challenge the grand jury with regard to the gender, with regard to how the letters are being sent out, and if we didn't have the information, we couldn't make a prima facie case. Or, if everything was correct, obviously we wouldn't pursue it further. But because everything is done in secrecy, we don't know the race of the grand jurors. The district attorney's office does, and they wouldn't tell us. They could have revealed that. The Judge Hardcastle may have known.
Well, how does the district attorney's office know the race of the grand jury?
Because they're the ones who presented the case.
So you're saying they would observe the people, but that's not necessarily an accurate disclosure of racial composition.
Well, it wouldn't be 100% accurate, but it would be more than what we had.
And what did you have? Do you have the names even?
I just had the names.
First and last?
First and last names of the people who were on his grand jury.
On each of the three that?
On each of the three. We had that. We were trying to find
where
out.
Where did you get that?
Because it's listed on the document that's filed when they file the grand jury transcript. It's listed on there.
But that's it. And you got that yourself. You didn't get that from anyone
else. Right. We did not get it from anyone. We had put together a questionnaire at one time because the judge did not want us to contact any potential grand jurors. And so we thought, we'll let the court do it or let somebody else. And we were refused that request also. So basically, what it ended up being is an issue where no matter where we went, we were like a ping pong ball. We were going back and forth. And finally, we just came to the resolution that the documents don't exist. They're
shredded.
Ms. Dickinson,
do you believe that the basis for your, well, first of all, were you asking to see the 50, the 500? What was the request from the district court?
Well, what we were trying to do is follow the procedure set out in Massachusetts and Commonwealth versus Aponte. Mm-hmm. And in order to follow that procedure, we would have to find out the addresses and the names and information on the 500 to see where they're being sent. Then we'd have to compare it with the 100 and then with the 50 and make a comparison with that, and we'd have to hire an expert to look at it.
And is that what you told the district court you wanted? Is that what you told the district court you wanted, 500?
Yeah, that was what we initially said was 500.
Yeah.
You know, we didn't, like, lay out our plan, but we told them we need the 500, we wanted the 100, and we wanted the 50.
I understand the Aponte case, but under Nevada law, is the basis for your right to the prospective grand jurors constitutional or statutory?
I think it's both. I think it's both. I think it's the U.S.
What's
Constitution.
What's the constitutional basis?
The Fifth and Sixth Amendment under the jury, the grand jury. And I think that it's also under the Nevada Revised Statute.
You have about 2 minutes left. Do you want to
say
that?
Yes.
I have one question. On the specific acts rebuttal evidence objection that you raised on appeal, was objection made to that evidence in the district court?
It was, and they asked for mistrial.
I'm sorry?
And they asked for mistrial.
Okay, so you're saying the objection was preserved by timely objection when the testimony was put up on rebuttal?
That's my understanding. I mean, I don't remember if they objected and stopped the proceeding, but I know that there's a lengthy discussion about a mistrial and how this evidence was withheld, not given to them, and their request for mistrial and their objections to what occurred.
But did they object? I could not find in the record an objection on improper specific acts evidence. The argument on appeal is that Steve admitted on cross-examination the requirement that he register and whatever else it was, yet nonetheless the state went into that on rebuttal independently with specific acts evidence. And you make that point on appeal, but I couldn't find the objection in the transcript on that.
Your Honor, I can look and I can file a supplemental briefing. I remember that there was a big discussion about the fact that they opened the door themselves and that they withheld evidence from us.
Okay, thank you. Thanks. I don't need a supplement on it.
Mr. Brooks, on behalf of the state.
May it please the court. Good afternoon. My name is Parker Brooks. I represent the state of Nevada. Justices, the will of the legislature is clear. The statute on its face is clear. The statutory structure where targeting child pornography is clear. There are some times in some statutes where nothing more need be said. This is one of those cases. Appellant is not entitled to a volume discount, and that is essentially what is being asked in determining the unit of prosecution.
How do you differentiate this case from Wilson and Castile? Why is it different? Because as a former defense attorney, production seems even more dastardly than possession.
Yes.
Because with production, you're using the child, whereas possession is possession.
I would go so far as to almost say that this court has already inherently decided this issue in Wilson, because in Wilson, you found that the performance was a course of conduct, which obviously it was. There was only one performance of child pornography. The taking of the pictures occurred at one point in time. But also within that very same case, what was left undisturbed were the four instances of possession of child pornography that came out of that performance. And so I would differentiate it by saying that possession is not a course of conduct. Possession targets each and every image, because each and every image is an exploitation of these defenseless and vulnerable members of society at a time when they're in their most profound and traumatic, impressionable ages.
So is every screen on the DVD that she held up a separate image that could give rise to a separate possession charge?
I would say,
assuming it were pornography that she was holding up.
I'd say if it was a DVD film, that's covered in the statute, because the statute says any film, photograph, or visual presentation. So I would say that no. Now, if you took that film, stopped it, and printed out 200 pictures, then those now become photographs. And so I would argue that now they're photographs, now they're distributable, now they are a target of what the legislature was intending to go after, which was somehow stopping the exploitation of these children. By criminalizing each and every possession, it effectively curtails the promotion, production, and preparation of this. If you don't curtail each and every image that is possessed, then there can be an endless supply. So essentially, once you've accumulated your first image, then you could continue possessing an endless supply, so the demand would always be there. And the demand would increase due to this ability, and it would be essentially promoting and effectuating more victimization of these children.
I can appreciate that point, Mr. Brooks, but counsel says that it was the state that reproduced the photos, not the defense. So is it reasonable for the state to reproduce the photos and then charge for each count on the reproduced photos?
I don't think that interpretation of what actually happened is completely fair. What was found was 117 CDs and DVDs, 47 VHS tapes. There was a plethora. There was over 1,400 images. So, in an attempt to be fair and not to prejudice appellant and to make it as fair as possible, there were motions in limine filed by the appellant, and the district court and the district attorney agreed that no mention would be made of a sampling, no mention would be made of this was only portions. So what happened was the detective consolidated 25 images. They each show a different child. They each show different acts. They are clearly separate and distinct. Put them on a CD so that at trial it was condensed, and then they printed those pictures off for the jury.
So you're saying that the photos came from a variety of sources, not from a single DVD.
Correct. It was not one DVD that, oh, let's print these 25 pictures off. That's not what happened. This was a sampling, which was eliminated from any discussion during trial in order not to prejudice the defendant, and it really was just...
So why didn't you charge 1,400 counts?
Excuse me?
Why didn't you charge 1,400 counts? Well, why did you pick 25?
I wasn't the prosecuting attorney in there, so I would just have to say prosecutorial discretion. I would have to say that, I mean, that would be a overburdensome of the trial, especially because what was really intended to go after was the egregious sexual assault and lewdness of the minor. I mean, the child pornography was, I don't want to say, you know, minimal, but minimal compared to that. Essentially, what appellant's asking is, let's say the average person has 100, I don't know what the statutes are, but if they have 100 images of child pornography, if they're only allowed to be prosecuted for one, that's essentially only vindicating the victimization of 1% of those children who have been tortured and put through this process. The legislature intended to dry up the well. They wanted every single time someone went to the well to be punished because each image uniquely dehumanizes the child depicted therein. The maintaining and retaining of those pictures is what the legislature sought to go after.
So even though the procedure here is different, had it been as characterized by Ms. Dickinson, that is that the state secured a single DVD that contained 25 or 27 photos, you would have been able to charge and should have been able to prosecute 25 counts. Is that your argument?
Yes, that is, and because those would be visual depictions. Now, if that was a film...
So what would be the circumstance if the state had obtained in the search warrant, I'm just guessing, a magazine that contained 100 of these photos? Would the state be able to charge 100 counts for each page in the magazine?
And that's an interesting question. I mean, although it's not here before us, and a lot of states do have book within the statute. We in Nevada don't have book.
But the resolution of this case affects other cases.
Absolutely.
And so that's why I pose the hypothetical.
Yes, and so to answer the hypothetical, I would say that the pictures therein are visual presentations. Those are photographs. Those are contained within the book. And you could charge it as per visual presentation within that book. Now, there's an interesting temporal requirement because you usually would come into possession of the book all at one time, but the legislature doesn't go after a temporal requirement. It goes after the possession of a singular item. I mean, the items to be possessed, the objects which to be possessed under the legislature are listed singular. They're listed as film, they're listed as photograph, they're listed as visual depiction. So I would say that the any is a modification signifying that each item of contraband possessed is able to be punished. I understand that federal case law has sometimes deferred from this, the Bell versus United States case that was quoted within appellant's brief. However, I would just note that this court is under no obligation to follow the federal interpretation of a federal congressional statute when interpreting Nevada's statutory intent and Nevada's legislature's intent within this statute. At most, it's persuasive authority. And I think Nevada's statutory structure and Nevada's intent is clear. The legislative intent is clear. Justice, if you don't have any questions on that, would you like me to move to the grand jury?
I would like to hear about the grand jury issue, particularly how a defendant is to bring a challenge under 172.055 when the defendant encounters the difficulties this one did trying to get that information and then ultimately, as I understand it, was told the information had been shredded and therefore was wholly inaccessible. What do we do with that?
And Justice, I would note that my response would be that in NRS 172.055, it allows for a challenge to the array of the grand jurors that they were selected, drawn, and summoned in accordance with law. In accordance with law is listed in NRS 6.110. And that procedure was followed in this case. And the appellant had details and was told, yes, this was followed in this case. But moreover, appellant's initial motion was simply a motion for discovery requesting the race. I'm not sure the representation that appellant was challenging the grand jury array and the way it was composed is correct. I think it was just a discovery request. So that's different. Appellant knew and was informed of the process. The process is designed to go after a fair cross-section of the community, as set forth in Adler. To answer the question you asked, Justice Harsey, I'm not sure if I agreed. I think it's a statutory construction because I don't believe that the incorporation doctrine has yet reached the grand jury, and so that I would make that argument. But coming back to the process, that process is set up and outlined in NRS 6.110 in order to be fair, in order to have a non-discriminatory statutory structure. And so there's nothing in the record that ever shows that race or gender came in. Judge Bixler continued to say throughout the record, race wasn't an identifier. We don't have any information on race. And if you look at the thing that sent out, the structure of the grand jury question, race isn't on there. Race is nowhere to be seen. So I would suggest that this court should require a defendant seeking discovery of non-public information to make some sort of showing of facts sufficient to raise a suspicion that the jury pool was improperly constituted. That was never done. There was never a question. There was never any articulation that the procedure wasn't followed, that the procedure somehow unfairly treats an identifiable, cognizable group in the community.
How would they come by that proof, though?
I would say that the challenge that they're allowed to do is to the procedure. And the procedure was followed. That's the challenge they're allowed to make. Did you follow the procedure? Because otherwise, to require some full-scale investigation into the grand jury panel solely on a mere assertion, not supported by even so much as an affidavit based upon information and belief that there was some sort of improperly drawn or constituted jury, I mean, that would open up every jury panel, no matter how impartial and properly representative, to a full-scale inquiry, more accurately, a fishing expedition, which I would note that the first hearing.
Well, Mr. Brooks, let me pose a couple of hypotheticals. Now, it's been 7 years since I picked a grand jury in the Second Judicial District, but the procedure there, I think, is the same as in the Eighth. I wanted to pose a couple of questions on this point. First, is it your understanding that the application submitted by prospective grand jurors does not include an identification as to their race?
Yes, Justice. They were provided, appellant was provided the affidavit of the prospective grand juror.
Right.
Nowhere on there is race indicated.
And then the second question is, at least in the second, once the list had been obtained, the first 100 had submitted their names, the judges would nominate, each judge would nominate a member to the grand jury till you reached, I think it was 21 or something like that. And then they would decide some group were alternates and the rest were grand jurors. The question that's raised is this, if the affidavit of application does not reflect race, then how is a defendant supposed to be able to determine whether the judges simply appointed white males and contest that as not representative?
My response?
And I realize the state's in a tough spot because the state goes out and gets the affidavits and does your scope check, and then after that, you're no longer a part of the process. So you're here to a degree trying to defend what the district court did, and it's difficult because you lose control of the process. But that said, how does the, following up on Justice Pickering's point, how does one test the racial makeup in the first instance, and then how do they test that the judges haven't picked white males, for example?
So I'll try to respond. If I forget one of the questions, stop me.
I'm sorry for the length of the question.
So first, I'm not sure that the DA ever runs scope on that. I was told that's not a process. I don't know where that's come from.
We do.
Okay, so the DA does run the scope. But as far as that, the Judge Bixler continued to say race was not a part of it. So I'm not sure the judges in
What did he mean by that? Is he
said he was never provided anything with a racial indicator on it that
he's talking about when the jury was choosing.
When the justices randomly select people.
But if they attach a scope sheet, as they did with certain people, the race is on there.
Then Adler would... That wasn't the impression that Judge Bixler had or conveyed. Furthermore, there was some talk, and in one of the memos, that the minutes of that court proceeding were available. And so you could find out who the judges selected. There was some matter that was a matter of public record. It's never been found. I don't know if that's appellant's fault or our fault, or that was just never provided. But as far, you guys are aware of the racial makeup and composition of the district court judges. It's varied. It's not all white males. To suggest, and appellant's not suggesting this at all, and neither are you, Justice, but to suggest that basically the 37 justices got together, or district court judges, and tried to only get white males, that's not the process and procedure that the Supreme Court overturned in Vasquez.
Let me give you another 2 minutes, and I'm going to give her some extra time. Go ahead, because I think you're in the middle of discussing this grand jury, and I want you to answer Justice Hardy's questions.
Justice, did I miss some of those questions?
No, you didn't. Your memory is good. But I guess at the end of the day, and through no fault of the district attorney's office, the process that's being used doesn't allow for the defense to raise questions about the racial makeup. It doesn't allow the DA to do so, and it doesn't allow the appellate court to review that. The other problem is that in the context of selecting a grand jury, which is quite a bit different than a petit jury, the first 100 who submit their affidavits form the basis for the grand jury. So if white females send in theirs first because they're more responsive than some of us males, you would end up with potentially a disproportionate number in gender, perhaps, even if you didn't know what the race was.
And it's those who are willing. So that willing element changes everything. So that Pettit composition, that 100, is completely different. And I would just note that as much as Vasquez is completely different in this situation, because this court shouldn't overturn an indictment based on
this is why I raised the question about whether the source of this issue is constitutional or statutory. Because if it's statutory, this involves an interpretation of the process under the statute, and someone's due process rights are not implicated. If it's due process, then that's a different question.
And I would say that the statutory structure is the process that is in place, and there's no purposeful discrimination of an identifiable class due to that process. As far as the constitutional issue in Vasquez, that was intentional discrimination that no one can doubt. That was a violation.
Was there any argument in the district court that the selection process, and Justice Hardesty's raising it, perhaps white females returned these more quickly? Was there anything argued that there was an inherently biasing factor at play as this narrowed from 500 to 100 to 50 to 17? Or was the argument, rather, we just want to look at these, but they didn't attach any evidence or make any argument as to the legitimacy of the statistics? Do you see what I'm getting at?
Correct. There was never an assertion that there was anything wrong. There was never any assertion that, oh, this might have happened, nothing. And I don't mean it pejoratively.
You don't have any statisticians or any people addressing the survey or how this could have biased that process?
No, Justice.
Thank you, Mr. Brooks. Ms. Dickinson, I'll give you your 4 minutes now.
Just to start off with the child pornography briefly, the state argued that, you know, Wilson left the possession counts undisturbed. when they were deciding the use of a minor for pornography. Well, the Wilson case, they did not raise the same issue that we are raising here. Wilson raised that possession was a lesser included. We're raising a different issue here than Wilson. And we're saying that the analysis the court used in the use of a child in pornography would be the same analysis that would apply in our case for our statute. With regard to how many DVDs or CDs they had, I know there were a few. It's my understanding. I thought that they took them off the sampling off one. We were never given a copy of any of these. None of them were introduced into the record at any time.
Ms. Dickinson, I appreciate your point, but counsel's description of what happened seems to be consistent with what I thought the record showed, and that was counsel were resolving the extent of this material and how to condense it for purposes of trial. Isn't that the case?
My understanding is that the detective said there was a lot of material. None of it was turned over to us, so we don't know what was there. My understanding from talking to the trial attorney during this process was that she believed they made a sampling from one disc. So there was a disagreement, I suppose.
What is? Wasn't there a transcript of the court and counsel resolving how these photos were going to come forward?
I don't believe there was. There was our writ of habeas that we filed when they introduced the 25 pictures and what was alleged to be a CD at the grand jury. So we filed a pretrial writ, and we argued it was only one.
Okay.
And it was my understanding that was the basis of it, because we believed it came from one CD. Or even if it came from others, that it would still count as one unit of possession.
Okay.
Though we're not conceding he possessed anything because he was in jail at the time.
Mm-hmm.
With regard to the grand jury, I remember when I started in our office a long time ago, everybody said, well, you know, the grand jury could indict a ham sandwich. Because we saw so many indictments come down and we didn't understand how they came down or why. I think that, you know, in looking at this issue, I think there is an issue, a problem with the selection of the grand jurors, and the problem we have is we cannot get any proof that there is a problem. We can't prove the race, we can't prove the gender, we can't prove how the letters were sent out because nobody will give us the information because it's not kept.
Can you, though, address as a matter of policy your opponent's argument that there has to be something more than just a request to see all this information, or you're going to invite fishing expeditions, in essence, in every instance, that there has to be some more teeth to that request, some more analysis to justify it?
Well, part of the problem is that in order to have some teeth to it, we would need the information. We would need the information to examine it, which is what we were trying to get, to decide how we were going to proceed. We even offer that the court give it to us as anonymous people. We would just give people a number if the court was afraid that we had information on people we shouldn't have. So we were trying to file the Massachusetts case to collect this information so we could bring it before the court.
Go ahead and finish your thought.
Bring it before the court. It was true that initially all we did is argue race. However, when we put the questionnaire together, by that time we were following the Massachusetts case, and we put a questionnaire where we asked for gender, we asked for race, zip code, and age, because we asked for these three
things.
But
you weren't arguing that the procedure was had inherently biasing defects?
Well, I think the procedure does have inherent.
But were you arguing that in this case?
Well, let me clarify, see if I understand. The procedure that they say occurred because they say they filed a statute. They have no proof that they did because they kept no records of it. If the judge had seen some records and said, yes, see, here we go, these are confidential in camera, I can see that they filed a statute. So if that's your argument, you lose. Or here's the names of the people. I mean, the judge could control this. You know, but granted, we don't have the information, so we can't make a prima facie case. And it really is a problem because everything's done in secret. It's not like with a regular jury, we can kind of look at them before trial and sort of size it up a little bit and guess. But we can't do anything here. We're not allowed in the grand jury. So we have a statute, and we have a constitutional right to challenge something that is secret.
You may have to start filing Markham notices and then walk into the jury room because you can't say anything, but you can at least observe and then have the client say, you know, I prefer not to testify. Well, then you'll see if there's Asians and Hispanics and African Americans, old people, young people.
Well, that's a thought, but it'd be helpful.
You're not going to charge for that advice.
I just want you to know, when I was a baby public defender, we challenged the grand jury. And in those days, the county commissioners used to pick the grand jurors. And then that resulted, at least our challenge, even though we weren't, we tied up a bunch of narcotics cases, they changed it to this statute, which Justice Hardesty and I participated in, him in Reno and me in Las Vegas.
Thank you. Any other questions?
I just would make an observation, Ms. Dickinson, Ms. Brooks, excellent arguments, and thanks for your help today.
Oh, thank you.
And I enjoyed it, too. Thank you very much to both of you. Both credits to the Public Defender's Office and the DA's Office. And you can tell your bosses, Phil Cohn and Steve Wilson, that Justice Cherry, Justice Hardesty, Justice Pickering appreciated both of what you've done, especially coming to Carson City. Thank you very much. This matter stands.